Today is Wednesday, February the 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Bunganyi in Washington. Coming up, as the coronavirus continues to spread, what is the best measure to gauge the state of the global economy as stock markets dip?
I'm not actually looking at economic indicators. I'm looking at health indicators.
Plus, Democrats took to the debate stage on CBS News as the race for the White House continues.
Bernie Sanders' analysis is right. The difference is I don't like his solutions.
And Washington argues Iraq to protect U.S. troops, coalition diplomats, and more. Those stories and more coming up next. The World Health Organization now reports that there are about 81,000 confirmed cases of the COVID-19 around the globe. But for the first time, the number of new cases outside China is greater than the new cases in China. At least 78,190 cases have been found in China, with 2,718 cases, death. Now, there are at least 2,790 cases in 37 countries and 44 deaths outside China, where the disease was first identified. The coronavirus outbreak continues to spread, with infections in 33 countries, the latest being reported in Afghanistan, Bahrain, Iraq, and Oman. European governments are readying plans for coping with a possible coronavirus pandemic, although the numbers of COVID-19 cases are still small in Europe compared with Asia. Officials in several countries admit that they expect the novel virus to spread and say they are developing plans to cancel sporting events and concerts and reduce public transportation services while imposing travel restrictions and shutter schools. European Union leaders are still hopeful that member states will refrain from imposing border controls within the Schengen area of visa-free travel, but they acknowledge that the scale of the public health crisis will most likely determine the reaction of national governments. Some public health experts say the time is right to start planning for a pandemic, as they suspect there are far more cases in Europe than they are known. The U.S. government response to the spreading virus divided lawmakers as congressional Democrats disagreed with President Donald Trump's assertion that it had been contained within the United States. The president is to hold a news conference on the coronavirus in about 6 hours. Dr. Nancy Messonnier, director of the National Cancer for the National Center for Immunization and Respiratory Disease at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, said containment efforts thus far have been largely successful, but
it's not so much a question of if this will happen anymore, but rather more a question of exactly when this will happen and how many people in this country will have severe illness.
The U.S. military officials in South Korea on Wednesday confirmed the first infection of a U.S. service member with the new coronavirus. The 23-year-old male has been placed in self-quarantine at his home at his Army base in U.S. Forces, Korea said. With the 2020 Summer Olympics in Japan just a month away, there has been some questions as to whether or not they will take place in the wake of the coronavirus. The International Olympic Committee and officials in Tokyo say yes, but not everyone is so certain. The AP's Julie Walker has the story.
Former International Olympic Committee Vice President Dick Pound told the Associated Press there's a three-month window to decide the fate of the Summer Games. However, a spokesman for the Japanese government says the IOC is going ahead with the Tokyo Olympics, and Pound's opinion doesn't reflect the official view. The coronavirus that began in China has infected more than 80,000 people, around 900 of them in Japan, and 57 here in the United States are being treated, according to the government. The death toll globally is more than 2,700. I'm Julie Walker.
This week has seen the global stock markets dip over concerns about the spread of the coronavirus. Financial markets in several countries rallied Wednesday after falling sharply Monday and Tuesday on fears that the coronavirus spread will affect economies. Key U.S. stock indices were up 1% on midday after falling about 3% on Tuesday. Gary Hofbauer is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. He spoke to International Edition's Steve Miller and says that while stock markets are getting a lot of attention, That is not what he's watching to determine how healthy the global economy is.
The most specific two things I'm looking for are, one, a reliable test that can detect before a person has developed antibodies whether that person has been is now carrying the coronavirus. We do not have that test now. Secondly, I'm looking for a vaccine that can be administered to people to protect them, as we use vaccines against the flu, to protect them against the coronavirus. We do not have that vaccine now. So I'm not actually looking at economic indicators. I'm looking at health indicators, because the current spotty evidence suggests that a person can be a carrier without showing much symptoms for up to 30 days. And what that means is that we've got carriers going all over the world and exposing people, which has approximately a 2% mortality rate. That is very scary, because what it means in economic terms is that governments, without these two tests, without those, what governments are going to do is all kinds of quarantine measures, which interrupt all supply chains that you can imagine, as we've seen in extreme cases in China and in South Korea.
Now, if we go, well, let me follow up on that really quickly, because, sure, you know, speaking at the WHO on Tuesday, they said one of the, you know, things that China did correctly was institute some of these quarantines and movement restriction policies to try and reduce and limit the spread of disease. Now, if we take a look at the quarantine on the Diamond Princess, which was the vessel that was docked in Yokohama, Japan, and how that spread among the people on board the ship there, and presumably, however, the virus is being spread in the city of Wuhan, which is the epicenter of this. You know, as people continue to travel, as the incubation period appears to be somewhere along a month, you know, you have all this uncertainty. And is that the uncertainty that we're seeing now reflected in the market as the number of cases continues to grow up? And, you know, governments are now saying, hey, we need to, you know, take more money out of our budgets and give it to preventative measures. And as companies are starting to miss some of their key deadlines because of supply chain, you know, restrictions and, you know, reductions in the follow through of goods?
Oh, absolutely. We're seeing all that, because without the tests and the vaccine, which I mentioned, the only thing governments can do is interrupt interactions between people. And that means, you know, halting airlines. It means a lot of precautions before the sailors board a, you know, a container vessel, because, you know, if they get the coronavirus in the middle of the Pacific, that's not good for moving that vessel. You know, ports where you get a lot of people working together, you're worried about that. So that's all that government can do, is interrupt interaction between people. And what is the economy? Well, it's basically interaction between people, but also interactions over the internet. So you do have both. But interaction between people have been, seriously limited in some countries, and they will be limited in more countries until, a more targeted approach can be devised.
That was Gary Halfbauer with the Peterson Institute for International Economics speaking to our own Steve Miller. U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders was the target of his rivals for the Democratic presidential nomination in the latest televised debate held Tuesday in Charleston, South Carolina. Sanders has emerged as the national frontrunner after victories in the first three nominating contests. But his rivals contend that the Democratic Socialist would lose to Republican President Donald Trump in November's national election. For more on last night's Democratic debate, I'm joined by VOA's national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, thank you for joining us here in studio. So Democratic candidates held their 10th debate last night. What are some of the key takeaways from last night's debate?
Well, Jackson, I think Bernie Sanders was the subject of criticism, of attack by his rivals. And for the first time in the campaign, there was a concerted effort by most of the contenders to go after Bernie Sanders and to question whether or not he would be the strongest candidate to take on President Trump in November. Now, the last two debates here have gotten very chaotic with the Democrats. You can start to see that some of these candidates are feeling the pressure. We have a big contest coming up Saturday in South Carolina. That will be an important test for former Vice President Joe Biden. He's basically staking his campaign on doing well there. Basically, he's even agreeing with people who say he has to win on Saturday. But just 3 days later, we have what we call Super Tuesday. 14 states hold primaries. More than 1,300 convention delegates will be at stake for the candidates. So we're in a very important stage in the campaign. And I think what we saw on Tuesday night in South Carolina was sort of an effort by the rivals of Sanders to slow him down a bit.
Now, headed into Super Tuesday, who would you say has momentum on their side? And is South Carolina a make-or-break moment for Joe Biden?
I think it is going to be a very important test for Joe Biden. I think he helped himself with, from what I could tell, was his strongest debate performance of the whole primary season. On Tuesday night, he was more focused, he was more animated. But certainly, you know, the one who still continues to have momentum heading into Super Tuesday is Bernie Sanders. Sanders is well positioned, for example, in some of the states that will vote on Super Tuesday. And the two largest states are going to be holding delegate elections, and that's California, with over 400 delegates at stake, and Texas, with 228. And Sanders is certainly well positioned in California. So the question will be, you know, could former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg make a bid? He's advertising in the Super Tuesday states. Those are the first states he'll actually be competing in. Might he make an impact? And that's why the Super Tuesday results will be so important to sort through next week.
Now, speaking of Michael Bloomberg, after his much-panned performance in the last debate, how did he fare last night?
I think he was sharper. He was more engaged. He didn't look as lost as he did in the first debate. But there were still moments there where he was on the defensive, especially when targeted by Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren. But speaking of Warren, you've got Senator Amy Klobuchar, you've got Pete Buttigieg, the former mayor of South Bend, Indiana. All of them are trying to hang in through Super Tuesday, but a lot of their campaigns may be on life support here. So they were all, I think, feeling the urgency of the moment to make a strong case that they should continue. And of course, money is the lifeblood of politics. And if they can't continue to get those campaign donations after their performances and after how they do on Super Tuesday, some of their campaigns could come to a close.
That was VOA's national correspondent, Jim Malone. Jim, thank you for joining us here in studio.
Sure.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
It's been a little over 15 months since NASA's InSight lander touched down on Mars. The space agency reports that six new published papers detail some of the findings made by InSight, both above and deep below the red planet's surface. Scientists found that Mars trembles much more than expected, with 174 seismic events, or Mars quakes, over a period of 235 Martian days, or 241 and a half Earth days. Mars doesn't have the same tectonic activity that causes quakes here on Earth, so scientists suggest volcanic activity are causing the Mars quakes. While the red planet lost its magnetic field billions of years ago, InSight provided information that when it did exist, it magnetized rocks located between 61 meters and several kilometers underground. The scientists are still waiting for data from InSight that can determine whether Mars has a solid or liquid core. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. U.S. State Secretary of State Mike Pompeo this week argued Iraqi Prime Minister designate Mohammed Alawi to protect U.S. troops and stressed Iraq's obligation to protect American and coalition diplomats, forces, and facilities. Pompeo also pressed Iraq's new government to end violence against the thousands of protesters who have gathered in Baghdad and address their grievances. Iraqi lawmakers have scheduled a vote of confidence in the Alawi government for Thursday. VOA's Mohamed El-Shanawi spoke with Ismail Al-Sudani, former Iraqi military attaché in Washington, about the vote of no confidence and the pressure the government faces between anti-government protesters who want foreign troops out and its ally, the United States.
Actually, what did prompt this request is to remind the designated prime minister of his government's responsibilities and duties towards the U.S. and coalition forces, as well as the diplomatic missions in Iraq. The departing government has failed to deliver its obligations, as they have many times declared that they are obliged to protect the U.S. and coalition forces, facilities. As a result of that, the relation has been critically intense due to the escalation between the U.S. and Iranian militias supported by Iran. That ended in exchanging the shelling and strikes, and ultimately the Iraqi parliament's decision to demand from the prime minister to remove the U.S. forces from Iraq. The U.S. administration would like to turn a new page with the new government in order to restore the cooperation and relation to normal. Both governments value the importance of keeping diplomatic, military, and economic ties. It's also essential for the U.S. and Iraq government to maintain relations at the highest level, as there are many common interests to be achieved in the near terms and the future. I think both countries also are partners in fighting ISIS. The U.S. is obliged to build and protect democracy in Iraq, and the U.S. is a crucial player in building the capacities of the Iraqi institutions. So I think this is one of the conditions that set for the designated prime minister from the U.S. administration, so he would gain some kind of support when he will be getting the vote to assume the responsibility.
So is Iraq capable of honoring this obligation when angry pro-Iran protesters have been in the streets calling for U.S. troops withdrawal?
I think the crowd who is calling for the U.S. forces withdrawal in the streets has been mobilized by the Shia political parties due to the recent escalation between the U.S. and Iran. I think the Iraqi government is not entirely in control of the armed groups that belong to the Shia parties. Therefore, some political parties are more powerful than the government. But I trust that the new government and domestic players would consider the political channels to understand the importance of the U.S. presence in Iraq to defeat ISIS and build the security forces' capabilities. It all depends on the new government's ability to move things forward and compromise the tension around the U.S. forces' presence in Iraq.
Pompeo also emphasized the urgency with which Iraq's new government must put an end to the killing of protesters and address their grievances. What do you make of that?
The prime minister, in his speech, stressed on bringing all who involved in killing the protesters to the justice through independent and transparent investigation. So I think Secretary Pompeo is stressing on the new government to hold the protesters' killers accountable and bring them to justice, also to address the grievances of the demonstrators. I see this statement as a condition also to designate prime minister to accomplish so he may win the U.S. support and so he can work with the U.S. administration to normalize the situation in Iraq.
Iraqi lawmakers decided to schedule a vote of confidence for the government of Alawi Thursday. Would the parliament vote in favor?
Apparently, the designated prime minister is trying to appoint non-partisans and technocrat cabinet. He is facing some opposition from political parties, but people demand reformation in the political system by removing the ethno-sectarian quota. So any political party would oppose this move may put the party in the confrontation with the people. Second, Iraq cannot tolerate more delay. Ultimately, the prime minister has to compromise with the political parties before the confidence vote, which I think will be in favor of passing the cabinet.
That was Ismail al-Sudani, former Iraqi military attaché, speaking to VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shanawi. And Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has decried what he terms as double standards employed at the UN Human Rights Council in favor of Western democratic values at the expense of what he calls the legitimate sovereign rights of nations to do not fall within the Western orbit. Lavrov presented his views at the council. Lisa Schlein has more.
Sergei Lavrov did not hide his disdain at the so-called country-specific resolutions adopted by the Human Rights Council. He asserted the resolutions had become an increasingly popular pretext to interfere in the internal affairs of sovereign states. The Russian foreign minister criticized the imposition of unilateral sanctions often used by Western countries to topple governments seen as undesirable by them. He spoke through an interpreter.
This harmful practice leads to exacerbating confrontation and ultimately restricts the ability of ordinary citizens to exercise their legitimate rights. The reliable securing of rights and freedoms is incompatible with double standards. In this context, one can only wonder at the fact that some Western partners, who declare themselves champions of democracy, deliberately turn a blind eye to the outrageous suppression of human rights in Ukraine.
Lavrov didn't offer names, though it is common knowledge the United States, European Union, and other countries have imposed sanctions on Russia and the Crimea. This following Russia's military intervention in Ukraine for what they called support of the separatist rebellion in eastern Ukraine in February 2014. The UN Human Rights Office reports the war has resulted in the deaths of some 13,000 people, a quarter of them civilians. Another 30,000 people have been injured, and 1.5 million people have been internally displaced in Ukraine since the start of the conflict and Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. Lavrov also lashed out at Western powers for their support and justification of military actions committed by what he called radical and terrorist groups in Idlib in northwestern Syria.
It is difficult to find any other explanation for calls for peace agreements to be concluded with bandits, as we see regarding the situation in Idlib. That is not caring for human rights. That is capitulating before terrorists or even encouraging their activities in violation of international treaties and numerous UN Security Council resolutions.
Lavrov's observations come just as the United Nations has warned of a potential bloodbath of hundreds of thousands of civilians in Idlib if Russian-backed Syrian government forces do not stop their indiscriminate carpet bombing of the region. Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov urged the Human Rights Council to resolutely renounce what he called double standards. He said that's why his government has decided to run for a seat on the 47-member council for its 2021-2023 term. Russia lost its bid to become a member in 2016 after a campaign by rights groups over its bombing of Syria. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that's going to do it for us today. You have been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and engineer, PJ Elliott, thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Have a great day, everyone.
Everybody, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. This weekend, tune in and treat yourself to an hour of amazing Pan-African music. Current Afropop, coupe décalé, gospel crossover, Afrobeats, bonga flavor, and neo-traditional tunes will delight and excite you. The chill, classic throwback sounds of Wasalum, Maskandi, and Juju music will relax you and make you smile.
That is so beautiful. Oh, say it one more time. And Song of the Week, Shekere, by Yemi Alade and Anjali Kijo, will make you want to get up and dance. It's going to be so much fun. So join me this Sunday and the following Saturday at 15:05 and 20:05.